Part 7, Chapter 22. Mingo looked at Harper with pride in his eyes. "You were good. You did fast across the ladders, Dee Dee," he offered unsolicited praise. The climbing Sherpas called most women Dee Dee, a title meaning older sister. Harper smiled broadly but was tired. "Daddy Bob," Harper said, looking at his bright eyes. As the team sat down at the football field about halfway up the ice fall around 18,500 feet, it was near this spot that in 2014, an ice Iraq release took so many lives. Dutch and Tony sat on their packs drinking water with electrolyte replacement powder in it. The couple wolfed down a couple of Snickers bars. Pablo looked tired, staring at nothing with his glazed eyes. And buddies took photos of each other. But Jim, well, Jim looked old. He sat down in the snow, not taking off his pack. The first rule of climbing and to take short, efficient breaks is to take off your pack. Immediately upon stopping, the process is to take off your pack, put another layer on to keep the heat that you've already generated close to your skin. Then you take out food and water. You sit on your pack and take on calories and fluids. The break should last no longer than 10 or 15 minutes, and Jim was far behind. John Paul sat down next to him. "What's up?" The return climb to base camp was mostly uneventful, and the team took naps until dinner. Low dark clouds blocked the sun, creating a chilly afternoon. The team was quiet over dinner, tired from the day, and the weather was matching their mood. The next day, they awoke to the usual sounds of hissing gas stoves. This had been a nice signal that the cooks were making breakfast and fresh coffee would be ready soon. But the sound was different this morning, muffled, muted, not the usual high pitch. Harper glanced at her altimeter watch and it said 7:30. Usually by now, her tent is bright with the morning sun, but today it was dark. Then Harper understood as Mima came by shaking the outside walls of her tent. She heard several inches of snow sliding off, revealing more light. More snow had fallen throughout the night, and it was still snowing. "Good, today was already a rest day," Harper called out to Mima. On days like this, climbers usually settle in and find their rhythm. There would be the usual three meals, and with the weather, no acclimatization hikes to Camp 1 on Pumori or any other hikes around base camp. This would be a true rest day, except for some business that needed to be conducted. "You okay?" Claudia asked, hopeful of her future mark. "Yeah, surprising how hard that was. I bailed on Denali's head wall, but I thought, you know, I learned a lot and I could do this," he said, looking at her boots. You can, Harper said, leaning over to look into his distant eyes. "Can we have some coffee?" John Paul sat outside Jim's tent. "Sure, what's up?" he replied while unzipping the door. They walked over to the dining tent and Jim had a bad feeling. No one else was there. "You know, Jim," John Paul started, "you were pretty slow in the ice fall yesterday. Last one to the football field and you weren't taking good care of yourself." It was John Paul's job to monitor his climbers, to help and support them, but also to protect them for themselves. "Yeah, I had an off day. I know what it is. I didn't sleep well the night before, and I should have drunk more water. Won't happen again," he began the negotiation. "Last year, you struggled to get to C3 and before ending the expedition. What'd you learn from that experience?" John Paul countered. He sat back in his chair, and Jim took a long drink of coffee. He debated if coming back only 10 months after attempting last year was too soon. Did he really have enough time to recover? He talked to his friends in the company he used last year. All said that he was taking a chance at his age, but he was a different company this year. He came back last year beat up, physically, mentally, emotionally. He had trained hard and thought he could summit, but discovered he had seriously underestimated what it takes to climb Everest. He had committed the greatest sin that a climber can commit, arrogance. He overestimated his capability and he underestimated the mountain. Even though Jim knew that only about 40% of those who get above base camp go on to summit, he had gotten to the top of Denali and Aconcagua, plus Mont Blanc, the Eiger, Matterhorn. But this was a decade ago. He had kept himself in good shape, working out regularly, but was it good enough? "Okay, let's see how you do on this rotation to C1 and C2. I'm not going to put any pressure on you with climb times. We'll know if you can do this or not. And to be clear, you can't go for the summit if I think you're in danger. Got it?" John Paul walked away. Jim stumbled back to his tent, conflicted. Should he just give up now? Or should he keep going and try harder? "I know what I have to do. I need to climb smarter, not harder. And with that, he began to develop his strategy. Chapter 23, Climbing to Camp 1 and 9 years later. With an introduction to the Coombe Icefall completed for our fictional team, now they returned to rotations to Camps 1 and 2 in the Western Coombe. They were treated to magnificent views of Everest, Lhotse, and Nootsie. It was just magical. On a personal note, Alan, me, telling the story, I was at Camp 2 on April 25th, 2015, when the 7.9 magnitude earthquake occurred. Over 9,000 Nepali citizens died and 22,000 were injured. Over 20 people died at Everest Base Camp from an avalanche that came off the ridge between Pumori and Tengri. Many, many people performed heroic acts to save lives, but still many died, too many. That experience was life-changing for many, including myself. Unlike the remembrances of 2014 Serac release that took 16 lives and is remembered with no climbing, April 25th is not, but still remembered by many. Dawa addressed a group of the Mount Everest Guides team. April 25th, 2020 is a five-year remembrance of the 2015 earthquake. And now in 2024, we're almost at 10, actually 9. Nepal lost 9,000 citizens, including 20 here at base camp. Let's take a moment to remember them all. Everyone became quiet, lost in their own thoughts and how fragile life is, how precious a planet can be, and how to remember to live each day, each moment to the fullest. You know the drill from the other day, up at 3, breakfast at 3:30, walking at 4. Everyone did great being on time and ready last time, so let's get it done again. This is a very important rotation of camps 1 and 2 for our acclimatization. We want to pace ourselves, but also get through the icefall as fast as possible. Let's work on making the breaks more efficient. Let's make them shorter. We don't want to lollygag up there. It should take between 5 to 7 hours to reach Camp 1, where we'll spend 2 nights. John Paul announced all of this over dinner. No one was surprised getting to know his style by now. Jim received a few glances. People were worried about him. Several on the team saw his performance to the football field the other day. Plus, he had turned back at Camp 3 just a year earlier. Sensing the concern, Jim decided to speak up. Hell, I know what you're all thinking, that I'm not up to this. Well, maybe you're right, but also maybe you're wrong. I'm putting all I have into this. As I said at dinner in Kathmandu, this is the last time I'm coming here. Harper walked over and sat in an empty chair next to him. Jim, we all know we support you. Let's get this done. The other members all nodded in support. Tony left for his seat. The Coombe Icefall is legendary in mountaineering. In modern times, it has an infamous reputation, causing many guides to refuse to let staff and clients go through it, fearing the ice release off the west shoulder of Everest. Many guides have switched over to the Tibetan side of Everest, feeling it's safer. George Mallory, seeking a safer route to climb to Everest than on the north side, in 1920, he inspected the icefall. He's quoted as saying, terribly steep, terribly broken. All in all, the approach to the mountain from Tibet is easier. And thus he shifted his efforts to Tibet. As we all know, he and Irvine disappeared on their infamous attempt on the Tibet side in 1924, never to be seen again. The Coombe Icefall begins at the foot of Lhotse and defines the Western Coombe. For about 2 miles, it drops rapidly to create the Coombe Icefall for about 2.5 miles. Around Everest Base Camp, the glacier makes a sharp southerly bend and continues for another 6 miles to 16,000 feet. The icefall varies in width from over half a mile to just a third of a mile. Like other similar glaciers, the Coombe moves as much as 3 feet a day. It goes faster in the center while barely moving on the edges due to friction against a rock wall. Also, the surface of the glacier moves more quickly than the bottom due to friction against the earth. It is this dynamic of fast and slow moving sections, plus the precipitous drops that create the deep crevasses, some over 150 feet deep, and towering seracs, some over 30 feet high. It's the highest glacier on Earth, and it's estimated to be retreating about 65 feet a year, and it shrunk about 3,000 feet between the 1960s and early 2000s. Between 1962 and 2002, it thinned by about 56 feet. So it's thinning at a rate of about 1.5 inches a year. It's thinned by 40 to 50 feet over most of its length. Every space camp is lower today due to the melting ice. In 1953, when Hillary and Tenzing summited Everest, Everest Base Camp was about 17,454 feet. Today, it's lower at 17,322 feet, about 200 feet lower. The team left on time at 4 a.m., stomachs full of toast, porridge, and eggs and coffee. They've become used to the food by now. It was hard to eat, though. They walked by the puja altar where Dawa had lit juniper boughs. Each person, except for one, stood silent at the altar before sweeping their open palm into the smoke, bringing it towards them, along with the blessed smoke. They did this three times, an auspicious number. The boughs would smolder until the climbers returned, managed by the cooks. The walk to Crampon Point seemed shorter this time. They found the end of the fixed ropes and clipped their jumars into it. This time, buddies took the lead with their personal Sherpas. Harper was content to stay in the middle of the pack. She, along with Dutch, Michael, the couple, and Jim, were bringing up the rear. John Paul was at the very end, sweeping the team. Their headlamps lit up the area just in front of their boots. But as the sun rose, there was just enough ambient light, so the headlight lamps were more of a placebo than a real help. After only 10 minutes, I found themselves breathing as if they had just run the fastest mile in history. Am I ever going to acclimatize? Jim asked himself. Dutch paused, hands on his knees. God, what's going on? He asked himself privately, not trying to show the stress. His personal climbing Sherpa looked over his shoulder. Basari, slowly, slowly, Mr. Dutch. He was pushing too hard, going too fast out of the gate. He needed to pace himself. About now, he heard voices behind him, a Sherpa train. They stepped aside as 10 Sherpas, each with a pack overflowing with pads, oxygen bottles, white rice sacks holding who knows what, went by. They seemed to be running and talking and laughing. They were having a great time. Harper wondered how they could muster such enthusiasm for such a dangerous job. Clipping back into the fixed line, they continued to climb. Suddenly, the team found the rhythm. They got into a cadence, their pace, their style. Their breathing calmed down. For the first time, Michael looked around. Ice. Nothing but ice. The boot track was clear ahead. The white nylon was like a shed snakeskin as it disappeared into the cracked ice blocks. An hour into the climb, the steep initial pitch of the icefall eased just a bit. It was time for a break. As they sat their packs drinking water, they tried to huff down an energy bar, but no one was really hungry. But they also knew that they were better off to force something down, get some calories in, along with some water. Instead of looking up, Michael looked down. Base camp. The tent city was widespread. He instinctively looked for his tent, their camp, a concoction was of something he knew instead of inside this world of uncertainty was the unknown ahead. Sighting the tents, he relaxed, but then he dawned on him how high he was. Yet he had hours to reach the next camp. This pattern repeated every quarter of an hour over the next 4 hours. One step at a time, they crossed the ladders, clipped into and off of the fixed ropes. Clip in, clip off, clip in, stay clipped in. Michael swore to each angle that it required an unclip the carabiner, perhaps the jumar. Why were the anchors so close together? It was a rhetorical question. Gripping together, the team took breaks at the well-known features. The popcorn, the football field, the prayer flag. They're all road signs and way stations along this icy highway that they had memorized in their minds from years of reading books on Everest. They expected that at each spot, it would be familiar, an old friend. But each one was drastically different than what they had envisioned. As the morning progressed, so did the traffic. They were now at ease with stepping aside to let Sherpas pass going up or coming down. Harper often offered a quiet namaste to each one, and they responded in kind. Even Jim was starting to feel good. Glancing at his watch, it was 8 a.m. Quickly, he tried to do math. How far had he come? How far to go? Are we close? He asked John Paul. The icefall appeared to crest. False top, Jim offered to the group. I know from last year. Tricked me then. The buddies were already ahead at their mirage, but closer to the tents, their mat, their sleeping bags. The buddies were moving well. Ladders, more ladders, but these were different. They didn't go across the crevasse. They went straight up an ice wall. This wasn't in the brochure, Dutch joked, and the rest of the group kind of giggled, but still stayed focused on their step by step. The icefall terrain had changed. Instead of a steady increase in grade, it now went drastically up, then down, then back up. It was a sign that the top was near. The icefall literally falls over the lip and into a rocky ravine buried under hundreds of feet of moving ice. Now the ice seemed to rise like a big city skyscraper. Their legs started to complain. They questioned the decision last night to pack the book, even though it weighed less than an empty pair of socks. Using the ladders required a concentration. The crampons hitting the aluminum rungs made it a tiny, tinny, metallic noise. Dutch found it comforting. He knew each step was stable and he was closer to Camp One. And the thin nylon fixed rope was her constant companion, the snakeskin. Nearing the actual top of this section, they approached an ice wall. There were two separate ladders in a vertical configuration. Each one was four ladders that were lashed together with the same thin nylon rope, which was their safety line. Jim had slowed down. He was far behind the rest of the pack. And buddies, they were already to Camp One. Any advice? Jim asked John Paul, who had been close by him the entire morning. Slow, steady, and make sure you're always clipped in. There's no need to rush. We're making good time. Jim appreciated John Paul's positive spin. They cleared the ice wall and stepped onto the Western Coon proper. Harper expected to see Camp One, but it was still half an hour away. Seemed like an eternity. The sun now peeking over Lhotse, it was blinding. Harper had made a mistake of not putting her sunglasses on when Mingma did. She wouldn't make that same mistake again. Quickly, she took off her pack and took her glasses out. Snow blindness was a real risk at this altitude. They set a smooth and steady pace across a labyrinth of shallow crevasses. Some were only a few feet deep, others a bit more. But it took precious energy to go up and down, and Harper's energy was running low. She looked up, expecting to see the south summit of Everest, the Lhotse face, but there was nothing. Only an expanse of wrinkled snow. It looked like a slept-on white bed sheet, rumpled and crumpled. They moved, climbed, gained elevation until the mirage of Camp One became real. A yellow speck in the distant, and soon another and another, they kept getting bigger. It was a line of tents. They had finally reached Camp One. Chapter 24, In the Western Coon. The Western Coon is known as the Valley of Silence, but it could be called a microwave oven. The icy walls that define the valley reflect harsh sun rays, and they create an almost unbearable environment. But just if it gets too hot, it can also get too cold. Whew, it's warm, Michael said to Jim. Warm? Hell, it's hotter than hell, he snapped back, wiping sweat off his forehead enough to fill a bottle. Afternoons at Camp One are notoriously hot. At almost 20,000 feet, there's no shade, and the intense sunlight reflects off the ice and snow-covered faces of Nootsy, Lhotse, and Everest West Shoulder. There's no escape when there's no clouds. Buddies, already at Camp One, had settled in and taken their sleeping bags and laid them on top of their tent. This maneuver reduced the inside temperature by at least 15 degrees Fahrenheit. Now it was only 85 degrees Fahrenheit. They stripped down to their briefs, seeking any form of comfort in this sweat lodge. No one cared what you looked like. Having a tent to herself, she also stripped down to the essentials. It seemed the Western Coon had become a beach in the south of France or Brazil. Harper thought about calling home on her Thuraya satellite phone. It cost about $1 a minute. But with the tents so close together, everyone would hear the conversation. So Harper decided to wait until they got to Camp 2 the day after tomorrow, where she could escape for some privacy. She desperately missed her kids. She desperately missed her husband, Mark. Lying back on the sweaty sleeping pad, she closed her eyes and thought of her family. Mingma walked past the tents one by one, collecting empty water bottles. He returned after a while with each one full. Pfft! Dutch coughed up with a gulp when he tried the new water. It was warm, almost hot. Well, I guess to melt snow, you've got to get the water warm. He defended his action, plus supporting the climbing Sherpas. They all kind of laughed at him. He spent an uncomfortable afternoon sweating, rolling over and over on the sticky sleeping pad, searching for that one position to maximize comfort while minimizing contact. No one found the perfect combination. Just as they settled into a rhythm to get through the afternoon, a loud crashing sound brought everyone from their tents like prairie dog colony out of their burrows. An avalanche off of Noopsy. It was pretty far away, so it wasn't really a threat, but it was a stark reminder of where they would be sleeping that night. They forced down a freeze-dried meal and noodles and some unidentified meat byproduct and prepared for the next phase, freezing. As the sun set behind Pomori, the winds picked up. Thermals. The temperature dropped 40 degrees in a matter of a minute. Hell, it's cold, Jim cursed at Michael. In the next tent over, Dutch looked at Tony and laughed. Tony zipped up his down jacket even tighter. The first night at altitude is tough for almost every Everest climber. Tonight would be their first true test and they would suffer. Buddies had to retrieve their sleeping bags from the top of the tent and place them where they should be, on top of the Z-pad, and then on top of an insulated thin air mattress. This combination worked surprisingly well to ward off the invading cold from the snow-covered ground. Almost everyone had either a minus 20 or minus 40 Fahrenheit down sleeping bag, a modified mummy with an extra large toe box so they could comfortably store their boot liners each night, and if lucky, maybe a water bottle filled with hot water. This technique will keep them warm and allow for a more comfortable start to the next morning. Harper took inventory before crawling into her bag. Water bottle, headlamp, snack, pee funnel, and bottle. They were all there. Harper grabbed her water bottle, still warm, and put it at the bottom of the bag. Her toes eased on top to tease out the last bit of warmth. Michael soon began a debate with himself about what he's supposed to be wearing in a sleeping bag. Taking off his short soft shell pants made perfect sense, but not the down jacket. But he had brought a minus 40 Fahrenheit bag for a reason, so go with it. Quickly, he made the decision to strip down to only his long underwear, but he put on his dedicated sleeping socks, since his toes get more cold at night. No gloves, but a knit cap for sure. He started laughing at his level of indecision. Why Michael struggled, Jim was already fast asleep. But Michael wasn't quite ready to go to sleep, but he put his headlamp on to read for a few minutes. It was cold. He could see his breath as he exhaled. Holding the book above his head, his hands got cold, so on with the gloves. He read a paragraph and put that book down. Now on his side, he finally began to relax. It didn't take long for their body heat to create a snug cocoon, and for the couple, lying in their individual bags, they still snuggled together. They closed their eyes, their minds wandered. As they were about to fall asleep, Michael now announced that he was asleep, as a freight train announces it's going past an intersection. Then one of the buddies coughed. It was deep, hard, and sustained. This had been going on for a few days, but they seemed to be doing well despite it. The couple looked at one another, kissed, and said goodnight. As the camp quieted, another gust of wind swept across the western coon. This one was so strong that ice pellets punched through the thin nylon tent walls. And another gust. The sharp ice hit their faces. They retreated like turtles into their bags for protection. The tent was beginning to heave like a dragon's spiny sides. They moved closer together in the middle of the shelter. Pablo, now with his eyes wide open, stared at the tent walls, wondering. He glanced at his watch and his heart sank. 8:36 p.m. Another gust and another brush on his face. The pattern continued. But somehow, with all the noise, he fell asleep for a moment, but awoke to a loud gasping sound. He leaned over to check on Claudia. She was fast asleep, but he was sure the gasp came from her. Claudia sat up suddenly. Oh my God, was I snoring? Claudia asked in embarrassment. No, you were experiencing Shane Stokes breathing. It's okay, and tried to go back to sleep. Pablo reassured her. They knew about this, but they were still unprepared. The simple explanation is that when you stop breathing due to a lack of oxygen at this altitude, your body notices and wakes you up with a gasp to remind you to breathe. Pablo looked at his watch again. 9:02 p.m. They had been in their bags for 2 hours, 9 to go. And then they wake up to get an active rest day at Camp 1. And the night goes on.